You know that feeling when you walk into a room and completely forget why you went in there?
Oh, absolutely. The classic stare into the open refrigerator.
Right, exactly. You're just standing there staring into the fridge or the closet, feeling this tiny, unsettling glitch in your brain.
Yeah, it's super disorienting for a second.
It really is. But usually, you shake it off, you remember you just needed milk, and your personal reality snaps firmly back into place.
Right, you recover pretty quickly.
But imagine if that feeling wasn't just a glitch. Imagine if that sensation was the actual fabric of reality unraveling around you.
Oh, wow.
Like, what if the things you thought were fundamentally true, the things you see, the memories you hold, even the people you know, were just incredibly well-crafted illusions designed to manipulate you?
I mean, that concept is the absolute definition of psychological vertigo. It forces you to question the bedrock of your own perception. And, well, that is exactly the tension we are exploring today.
Yes, it is. So welcome to the deep dive. Today, we are opening up a really fascinating collection of fantasy logs from the world of Mirari.
It's such a rich text.
It really is. We're pulling from two distinct narratives in these sources today. First, we follow a seasoned explorer navigating a literal forest of illusions. And second, we step into this high society noble parlor, where reality itself seems to be coming undone at the seams.
And our mission for this deep dive is to unpack the mechanics of deception within these logs. We are analyzing how the characters confront these altered realities.
Right, from physical traps engineered to exploit human nature, to manipulated memories that erase existence itself.
Exactly. But more importantly, we're looking at what these fantastical scenarios reveal about uncovering the objective truth in your own life.
So, a playful warning before we begin. By the end of this deep dive, you might find yourself taking a very hard look at the illusions you accept as reality every single day.
Definitely. It gets under your skin.
It does. So, we start our analysis in a place called the Golden Woods. And the text makes it clear right away that golden is a completely ironic naming convention here.
Yeah, there's nothing golden about it.
Nothing at all. The sources describe this suffocating, pitch-black atmosphere. The trees are so thick, their branches tangle together into this dense canopy that entirely blocks out the stars.
Like an ancient dusty cathedral.
Exactly, but one where all the lights have been permanently extinguished.
And, the sensory deprivation is entirely deliberate. Our main group, led by an explorer named Thomas, alongside his companions Simon, Rachel, and Hannah, they are picking their way through this treacherous, frost-covered terrain in the dead of night.
Which sounds miserable.
Oh, it's awful. And the darkness forces them to rely on their other senses, which makes them incredibly vulnerable to the auditory illusions the woods are known for.
Right, because they are already on high alert, having encountered fake gullies and phantom monsters earlier.
Exactly. The environment is actively hostile.
And the illusions are getting far more sophisticated. So out of the darkness, the group suddenly hears a woman screaming in terror.
Just a horrific sound.
Yeah, she's crying out that she is going to be lowered at sunrise and fed to the wolves. And accompanying her screams is this distinct guttural sound of snarling.
And Simon has a very intense reaction to this.
He does. The text notes he goes accoutred for war in a heavy bronze breastplate. He has this visceral reaction and instantly prepares to charge into the dark to save her.
Which makes sense. I mean, that is the classic conditioned heroic reflex. When a vulnerable person is in imminent danger, the societal expectation, especially for a warrior like Simon, is to just rush in without hesitation.
I was reading this and I immediately thought of the mechanics of a modern phishing attack.
Oh, that's a great comparison.
Right, because when you get an email claiming your bank account will be closed in 5 minutes if you don't click a link, the architecture of that scam is designed to bypass your logical processing.
It relies entirely on panic.
Yes, exactly. Panic, urgency, and your desire to fix a severe problem immediately. So Simon is essentially experiencing a magical phishing attack. It weaponizes his own protective virtues against him.
That parallel highlights the tactical brilliance of the trap perfectly. But Thomas, the Lord Explorer, approaches this entirely differently.
He's so calm about it.
He really is. He doesn't react to the emotional stimulus at all. He basically treats the situation like a tactical problem that needs to be stress tested, like a cybersecurity expert.
Right.
So he orders Simon to stand down, noting the logistical improbability of a noblewoman being suspended in these remote, freezing woods.
Which is a very good point.
Right. So he decides to break the line of sight and the physical plane of the illusion by changing his vantage point.
And his method for doing that is intensely practical. He locates a 50-foot tree with no lower branches and proceeds to free climb it in the dark.
While enduring biting winds and freezing bark, yeah.
Exactly. He is using brutal physical reality, the harsh elements, and the very real danger of a 50-foot fall to anchor himself while he investigates this magical construct.
It's such a smart move.
It is. He crawls out onto a high branch, and from there, he sees the entire setup. There's a damsel in a wickerwork cage suspended by a rope and pulley system directly over an earthen pit, teeming with prowling wolves.
And a tiny bandit camp just beyond that with smoldering fires.
Right. It looks like the absolute perfect rescue scenario.
But, and this is the genius part, when Thomas shimmies out to the branch, actually holding the pulley system and reaches out to secure the rope, his hand passes right through it.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. The rope, the pulley, the structural integrity of the trap, it is all a localized illusion.
Which completely changes the context of the threat. Because if Simon had charged in, clad in that heavy bronze armor, and swung his sword to cut that rope,
he would have cleaved through empty air.
Exactly. The momentum of his own heroic strike would have sent him plummeting straight into the wolf pit.
The mechanics of this deception are just masterfully cynical. I mean, the bandits aren't using magic to hide themselves or build physical barriers.
No, they're using sensory magic.
Right. They are constructing a scenario that requires the victim's predictable, noble behavior to complete the circuit. As Rachel, one of the companions, acutely observes, dishonest men do not trust others to be kind.
That's such a good line.
It is. They build traps for men more like themselves, but they will absolutely exploit a do-gooder's predictability.
Now, defeating a localized sensory trap in the woods is an impressive tactical feat. But the text escalates this concept of illusion almost immediately.
It doesn't let up.
Not at all. As Thomas and his group bypass this bandit camp, they encounter an entirely different breed of deception, one rooted deeply in ideology and identity.
Right.
They're creeping through the freezing forest when the sensory environment violently shifts. Hannah feels a sudden, unnatural rush of warm air, and Thomas catches the scent of something foul.
Described as a boiling swamp, I think.
Yes, exactly. A boiling swamp. And they track this thermal and olfactory anomaly to a gap in the rocks on a sloping hillside.
And they find a hidden chimney venting out of the earth.
Right, which implies a subterranean structure and an inhabitant who requires ventilation for something highly volatile.
So down the vent, Thomas hears a voice crooning about revenge, and it turns out to be the Dark Witch.
And rather than engaging in some complex magical duel, Thomas applies that same brutal practicality we saw earlier.
Yeah, I love this part.
It's so good. The group takes their folded linen travel sheets and physically plugs the chimney. They essentially weaponize the witch's own ventilation system to cause a massive backdraft of swamp-smelling smoke, forcing her out into the open.
It is a phenomenal subversion of the expected fantasy combat trope.
Yeah.
You know, you do not need a high-level counterspell to defeat a magical ward when you understand the basic thermodynamics of a fire in an enclosed space.
Exactly. So the smoke clears, the illusion masking her cave dissipates, and out walks the Dark Witch.
Uh-huh.
And the text delivers a huge character reveal here.
Yeah, the witch recognizes Thomas.
She does. She is actually the former bandit queen, a woman Thomas knew years ago and apparently held in really high regard. But she has been physically and spiritually ravaged by dark alchemy.
Her skin is papery. One of her hands appears dead and decaying.
And she wields a literal snake made of living fire, which is terrifying.
Well, the text establishes that she serves an archetypal dark master named Jack. In the lore of Mirari, figures like Jack represent the unseen corrupting forces that offer shortcuts to immense power in exchange for one's humanity.
Right.
So she is highly volatile, heavily armed with lethal magic, and holding a very deep, festering grudge.
See, knowing she is a lethal threat holding a fire snake, my initial reaction was to wonder why Thomas doesn't just have Rachel shoot her. I mean, Rachel already has a crossbow aimed at the witch's back.
So it seems like the logical choice.
Right. But looking closely at Thomas's actions, he steps out from cover and initiates a philosophical debate.
Which is a bold strategy.
Very bold. The only logical reason to expose himself to a fiery death is if he recognizes that her physical magic isn't the actual load-bearing pillar of the threat. He sees her belief system as the real danger.
That is a brilliant way to frame his strategy. Thomas is diagnosing an ideological trap. He wants to dismantle the false reality she has constructed for herself. Because if you listen to her justification for her state, she tells Thomas she traded her humanity for this dark alchemical power because she could not bear the indignity of being a mere farm girl.
She refused to submit to the systemic class structure.
Right, to the will of lordlings. Her entire descent into dark magic is anchored by the illusion that the only alternative to being a helpless victim is becoming a terrifying monster. She literally states, "Better to be feared than fearful."
So she has bought into a completely binary worldview. She believes power is strictly synonymous with domination and terror.
And Thomas methodically deconstructs this. He argues that the inherent superiority of lords is just another systemic illusion. He counters her binary view by demonstrating that true power is not about accumulating titles or instilling terror.
Right.
As a rootless wanderer, the power he values is the ability to inspire, to instill dreams and hopes in others. He diagnoses her aggression as masking profound vulnerability, telling her, "You only fear what you do not know."
And to prove his point, he asks Simon to step forward and show her the beauty of truth. Simon carries an ornately carved wooden box, and when he opens it, the text reveals the Holy Grail.
Which is a huge moment.
It is, and the mechanics of what happens next are fascinating. The Grail doesn't fire a destructive laser beam. It simply radiates a brilliant daylight-quality glow.
And that light acts as an ontological reset button.
Exactly. It forces the localized reality back to its baseline state. The flame serpent vanishes into a puff of smoke. The distant auditory illusions disappear. The golden woods actually appear golden and holy again.
Simon explicitly states the Grail is not a weapon or an object of dominion. It represents objective, undeniable truth.
Right.
When that unvarnished truth touches the witch's localized reality, every illusion she has wrapped around herself, both the alchemical magic altering her physical form and the ideological cynicism poisoning her mind, is systematically stripped away.
She collapses.
Yeah. Revealed not as a terrifying sovereign, but as a traumatized, huddled woman.
But faced with her own reality, her immediate instinct is to demand the Grail. She wants to brew an elixir to become young and powerful again.
Clinging desperately to that illusion of domination.
Exactly, so she can rule the wildlands. But Thomas refuses to give her the artifact. Instead, he pours normal water into the Grail, transfers that golden-infused liquid into a simple worn travel mug, and offers her a choice.
This is the crux of the encounter. When stripped of your comforting illusions, do you demand the power to rebuild them, or do you accept the humility of healing?
Such a powerful question.
It is. The witch drinks from the travel mug. The text describes her shedding a single black tear, symbolizing the purge of the corrupting alchemy.
And the physical damage reverses.
Yes. Her decaying hand heals, her youth returns, and she reclaims her original identity as the Bandit Queen. She articulates her revelation perfectly. "To breathe freely, to know no master, I did not know I lacked these till I had them back."
So the light of objective truth restored both the physical environment and her personal identity. That localized deception in the woods is incredibly dangerous, but the text takes this concept of illusion and scales it up to a terrifying degree when we look at our second source document.
It really does.
We move from the physical traps of the freezing forest into a much more insidious environment, the seemingly safe, highly controlled confines of a noble parlor.
And the transition in setting is vital because the deception here is systemic. It's not a bandit trap you can just outmaneuver, and it is not a corrupted witch you can debate.
Right.
The manipulation of reality here is woven into the very fabric of the kingdom's politics and history.
And the setting itself is a masterclass in blended realities. We are in Lord October's parlor. The text portrays Lord October as having antlers, which implies he is a physical manifestation of the land or the season, deeply tied to the ancient, fae-like politics of Mirari.
Yeah, his parlor is not a standard room.
Not at all. It is an autumn glen transplanted indoors. A real waterfall burbles down a rocky wall, a stream wends through a channel in the floor, and the ceiling is constructed of living, vibrant-leaved autumn trees.
It's a space designed to blur the line between the natural world and artificial construction, which perfectly mirrors the blending of truth and manipulation happening within the political sphere of the kingdom.
Exactly. Inside the sanctuary are Lord October, his handmaiden Yasult, a perceptive girl named Agatha, and a little blonde girl named Alice. Lord October makes a weighty political proclamation, followed by a stunned silence in the room.
The tension is thick.
Very. And in that heavy quiet, Agatha hears a distinct splash from the indoor stream. It is a massive breach of security in what should be a completely private sanctuary.
So Agatha tracks wet footprints to a decorative bush, and uncovers a spy hiding inside.
It is a young man with leaf-like hair named Tier 2. And the interrogation of Tier 2 is fascinating because his cover story falls apart immediately under basic stress testing.
It's pretty pathetic.
It really is. It reminds me of a badly programmed NPC in a video game trying to explain a pathing error or, you know, a hastily thrown together espionage cover that shatters the moment you ask for a detail.
Oh, exactly.
Like a toddler with chocolate all over their face claiming the dog ate the cake. First, he claims he was just hand pruning the bushes. When Agatha points out his hand is dripping wet, he pivots to blaming a silvery water snake.
And then when Lord October demands to know why he didn't vacate when the royal guards cleared the room, he claims he simply fell asleep.
The execution of his lies is almost comedic in its clumsiness, but the underlying implications are severe.
Very severe. Lord October is navigating intense political anxiety regarding the royal succession and the stability of the realm. Finding an active spy embedded in his private parlor signifies that the informational warfare in the kingdom has breached its highest levels.
And then the narrative abruptly shifts from comedic espionage to existential horror.
Yeah, this part gave me chills.
Me too.
Okay.
Agatha questions Tier 2 about a ripple that occurred earlier in the Great Hall. Tier 2 drops his foolish demeanor entirely. He admits he felt a sudden wobbly sensation.
Right.
He describes it as feeling as though he had suddenly tragically lost a very dear friend, but he could not remember losing anyone. He just felt the crushing weight of the grief.
This is where we return to that concept of psychological vertigo, but on a catastrophic scale. How does a mechanism like this ripple operate? The text implies it is a localized timeline alteration or a massive systemic memory wiping spell.
Which is horrifying.
Agatha immediately deduces the horrifying reality. Someone they all knew may have been completely erased from existence.
Like they were just deleted.
Exactly. The magic scrubbed the chronological facts of the person's life for everyone's minds, but the emotional phantom limb remains. The psychic wound of the loss is still there, even if the data is gone.
The psychological toll of that is staggering. I mean, imagine carrying the profound, heavy grief of losing your absolute best friend, but having an empty, echoing void where their face, their name, and your shared history should be.
It's unbearable.
It suggests that in the world of Mirari, human connection operates on a frequency deeper than mere chronological memory. You can erase the facts, but the emotional shape of the person remains imprinted on the people they loved. It casts a shadow as dread over Lord October's entire household.
And while the adults are grappling with the reality of this existential erasure, the text focuses on a quiet, parallel conversation between the handmaiden Ysolt and the little blonde girl, Alice.
Right.
This conversation contextualizes why the stakes of memory and identity are so universally critical in this setting.
Because Alice is not just a random child in the parlor. The lore reveals she is the presumed dead princess of the line of Umbrecht.
The core royalty of the realm.
Exactly. Alice has been forgotten for years, hidden away from the kingdom, and effectively erased from the political reality. Now she has been brought back to reclaim her place, and the psychological weight of stepping into an erased identity is crushing her.
She is a living victim of being forgotten. She confesses to Ysolt her profound anxiety about her mother, the queen. She says, "I have been forgotten in this very long time away. I don't know if the queen will like me. It makes me nervous. I want mother to like me."
She is grappling with the terror that the space she used to occupy in her mother's heart has closed up during her absence.
Yeah, she articulates her displacement beautifully, telling Ysolt, "I was always here. Here simply wasn't so very here till now."
Wow.
She has to learn how to inhabit her own life again, how to be a princess in a world that had written her out of the story. Both the Golden Woods and Lord October's Parlor showcase characters fighting desperately through the lies the world enforces upon them and the lies they tell themselves to establish what is actually real.
Exactly. Whether it is a bandit's physical trap, an alchemist's corrupted ideology, or a kingdom's erased history, the core mechanism of deception remains the same.
It relies on the victim's willingness to accept the illusion over the difficult, unvarnished truth.
Bringing this extensive analysis back to you, the listener, you are likely not going to face magical wolf pits or alchemically scarred witches on your commute today.
Probably not.
But you navigate highly sophisticated illusions constantly. We operate in an ecosystem of deepfakes, of highly curated social media personas designed to project an artificial reality.
Absolutely.
We encounter media engineered, much like that illusory cage in the woods, to bypass our logic and trigger our emotional outrage so we react without analyzing the source.
Furthermore, we battle internal illusions daily. I mean, the Dark Witch's core belief that she had to become a monster to avoid being a victim is a very real psychological defense mechanism.
Oh, for sure.
The systemic illusion of imposter syndrome, telling you that your presence in a room is a mistake, is a reality-altering deception you impose on yourself.
The most dangerous illusions are not the ones designed to trick our eyes. They're the ones designed to flatter our egos and validate our deepest fears. The Dark Witch's true illusion wasn't the fire snake she held. Her illusion was her cynicism.
And Thomas demonstrated that overcoming these illusions requires the courage to seek the objective truth. True power does not stem from accumulating titles, projecting terror, or maintaining a flawless facade.
Right.
It is rooted in simplicity, in integrity, and in having a tangible, positive impact on the reality of the people around you. You have to be willing to look at the unvarnished truth, even when the lie is infinitely more comfortable.
You don't need a glowing, magical artifact to clear the smoke out of your own life. Sometimes you just need to stop, refuse to react to the manufactured panic, and look closely for the rope that isn't really there.
Exactly.
But before we conclude this deep dive, I want to leave you with one final thought regarding that terrifying ripple in Lord October's parlor.
The profound, empty space left by a forgotten friend.
Consider this. If a ripple swept through your timeline right now and completely erased something fundamental from your past, a consuming passion, a pivotal relationship, or a massive failure that taught you everything you know, would the shape of the life you live today still reveal what's missing?
That's a heavy thought.
Even if you couldn't remember the facts of it, would the person you are right now still serve as undeniable proof that it existed? Keep your eyes open out there.